This is Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson. Sponsored by Know Better, Do Better, KBDB. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Dr. Phil Knight.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks for listening. At Food Secure Nation, we often talk about hunger in very human terms. Families, grocery carts, kitchen tables. But hunger also lives inside systems, inside policy decisions, inside supply chains, inside governance structures most people never see. And the way we understand those systems depends on where we sit. Today's guest sits in three places at once. She's a trained lawyer who chose to step into food security work, bringing a lens of evidence, structure, and risk. She leads a regional food bank in southeastern Minnesota during a time of volatility, when policy shifts translate immediately into pressures on warehouses and partner agencies. And she chairs the National Advisory Council for Feeding America, helping align local realities with national strategy inside the largest hunger relief network in the country. Three chairs, three vantage points, one system under stress. This conversation isn't about personality, it is about perspective. It's about how leadership scales from courtroom logic to warehouse reality to national alignment, and what happens when those perspectives are working together or not. Virginia Witherspoon joins Jerry Brisson and me, Dr. Phil Knight, next on this edition of Food Secure Nation. Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us here at Food Secure Nation. That's Jerry Brisson, myself, Dr. Phil Knight, and our guest, Virginia Witherspoon, the director for Channel One Food Bank in Rochester, Minnesota, and the chair for the NAC in the Feeding America world, which is the Network Advisory Committee or the National Advisory Committee. Which one is it, Virginia? What are you the chair of?
I think it is the National Advisory Committee.
All right. I like that better. Sounds more prestigious. Which should be. So welcome to the show. This is your first time with us. I can't believe that, but we're super excited to have you.
Thrilled to be here today. Thank you.
So let's jump in. We want our listeners to know you. So tell them a little bit about your journey because, you know, you are the lawyer who chose food security.
Yeah, I am. So I graduated from law school during the economic downturn and in 2008, and I was I graduated in 2010. The housing market fell in 2008, and I was really lucky to have a job at graduation, and I went to a lovely small town private practice in Mason City, Iowa, and in the small town, the young lawyers were expected to take court appointments. And it was either criminal or juvenile. And my boss didn't want me to end up in a jury trial I wasn't ready for. So I took juvenile cases. And so that was a small part of my work. But it ended up being child protection cases. Hmm. And all of my cases involved methamphetamine. So children removed because a parent was using methamphetamine. Or sometimes I represented the children who had been removed. And, you know, that was my first foray into social services and the social services system.
Hmm. Wow.
So then I needed to move to Rochester for my then husband's job. And so I was looking in Rochester, Minnesota. And the executive director of legal assistance of Olmsted County, so civil legal aid, was open. And I went for it. And then I ran the office and then also had a caseload, mostly doing domestic abuse work because that's what we kept my calendar open for. And when you're doing that work, you're really in it with people and understanding their economic situation because you're calculating child support. You're trying to figure out how they're going to get out of the women's shelter. And that's when I really learned the economics of being in poverty and the systems that keep people in that position.
Wow.
Yeah, that's deep. I mean, that's deep. And relationships teach you things that you can never learn in a book.
Yeah, you know, I always say that it's one thing to have a theory about welfare programs and if people should use them and who's using them. But if you have someone sitting in front of you who does not have enough food to eat or cash to pay rent, I can't imagine not figuring out how to help that person get what they need and be worried less about how hypothetically you think the system should work.
Yeah, I mean, what a powerful experience. What an amazing part of your story to get there through that path. So you had this experience, you started to understand better, and then you said, I want to be a food bank leader.
Yeah, and it was kind of crazy. So I had just come back to work. I didn't really take a maternity leave, but I was like back in the office and had childcare. So we'll say that I was out of my maternity leave. So my daughter was 4 months old, and someone from the Channel 1 board called me and asked if I would apply. And so I thought, you know, it's a big decision to stop practicing the law. It's really hard to get back in once you stop. But after 5 years at Legal Aid, I thought, you know, I'm ready to say that what I want to do is different than what I can accomplish practicing. And so Channel 1 had a bigger mission, bigger reach, and I was excited for a new challenge. And one thing led to another, and here I am 8 years later.
Wow, 8 years, no kidding.
Time flies.
It does fly. It does fly.
Wow. So I'm intrigued here, Virginia. How has your legal training, because I have a person on my team, Dr. Dawn Opal, who works as our lead innovation officer and now is president, but she's also held the position of general counsel on our team. And she thinks a certain way, and she thinks differently than anybody else I have around me. And so I'm just wondering, the legal training that you went through and those experiences, how has that helped you to approach leading Channel 1 Food Bank?
I think it makes me more or less risk averse depending on the situation. So there's some things that don't scare me as much because I have a law degree and I know the likelihood of them actually blowing up. And other things that I'm really insistent on, like making sure all of our employment practices are really proper, not just because we care about people, but, you know, also because you want to make sure you don't have that liability. And then, you know, looking really closely, there's plenty of contracts, plenty of compliance. I had no idea the level of compliance that food banks had to do before I had this job.
Right.
Yeah. And rightfully so. I mean, when people would talk to me about the things that that gleaners would have to do, I would say, you know, the thing that people think the least about but is the most important is food safety. You know, there are so many implications to it. It is so important for it to be right. And there are so many things you have to do to make sure it is right. And it's something people don't think about. Or the recalls, for example, the number of food recalls and how to make sure to manage all that. I mean, there's a lot of risk people don't think about.
You know, my, like, part-time jobs had always been in retail, so I had no food experience directly. So I even appreciate more restaurants and the training of servers and, like, the work that they need to do to keep everything safe. And I'll say that before I food banked, I would dump out the milk on the day that it expired, and now I'm way more likely to eat expired food and way more careful about leftovers.
Yeah. You don't keep temperatures of the food sitting on your counter?
Yes.
You know, that's the thing. And you should not eat that chicken that's been in your refrigerator a little too long. It's really not worth it. But the more the more you know. And then also, there's some compliance for us that makes a lot of sense. I mean, making the food, the safety, that's so important. Time and temp, things like that. But then there's other things that we're required to do that we have to do, but are frustrating. Like, I'm thinking about all the inventory regulation for the government commodity food, like CSFP. It's just, if you look at the time and energy it takes compared to, like, the benefit it produces, it's unfortunate.
That's a Yeah, that's a whole show right there. Right there. That's a whole show. So I've said for years, let's get you two to react to this for a moment. I've said for years, before food banks distribute any food, they pack the truck with trust and hope. And that's really what the food looks like. And so when you talk about food safety, you only get to violate that once. And then when you can be a part of the process that truly takes hunger off the table and you replace it with something more positive, like hope, then I think that's worthwhile. So I commend you, Virginia. And I understand where the risk at verse now is coming out. It's really in leftovers.
That's so good. That's so good.
Well, that's a great story. And I think it just endears you even more. And we want to unpack in the rest of the show some of the work that you've done there at Channel One, particularly around the issue of dignity, but also talk about the role that you are playing as the leader, as the chair for the National Advisory Committee in the Feeding America Network. So we're back with Virginia Witherspoon, Jerry Brisson, and myself, Dr. Phil Knight, in just a moment.
You're listening to Food Secure Nation with Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson, sponsored by Know Better, Do Better.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for being with us here on Food Secure Nation. Jerry Brisson, Dr. Phil Knight, and our very special guest, Virginia Witherspoon, who serves at the Channel One Food Bank in Rochester, Minnesota, but also is the chair for the National Advisory Committee for Feeding America. And we want to unpack that a little bit later in the show, Virginia, but, you know, right now, things are just smooth sailing. Food banks don't really have a lot of challenges in regard to food or people. So, I mean, what are y'all just doing at this time of the year with everything being so easy right now?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I'm in Minnesota, so it's been a...
No issues, no stress up there at all.
Just totally normal, yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah. You know, I think that it is a time to really lean into our values. I think back to right after the pandemic, when the money and the food were flowing, and it sort of felt like we could do anything. And then before we knew it, there wasn't enough food, and there was real pressure to figure out how we are going to get enough food and serve the growing number of people. Because when people got the extra pandemic SNAP benefits, by the time they lost them, when those benefits ended, groceries were significantly higher.
Yep.
So people ended in a worse scenario than when they started. And that's a real challenge.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, nationally, that same story is being told, right? A lot of food banks are still trying to figure out what to do now that not only has the government money gone down to the community and to food banks, but also the number of people donating, and some of that has gone down as well, because people give more when they know there's a crisis and they give less when the crisis is over. And so there's been a lot of trying to make up that ground as well. And of course, the six dimensions of food security, which we talk about on the show a lot, one of those is stability and another one is sustainability, and this feeds right into those two dimensions, because when you're pivoting all the time based on available resources, it's hard to figure out the next innovation. You know what I mean?
Yes, but I think when we listen to people experiencing food insecurity, we can figure out what the right thing to do is. And in these times of a financial crunch, what we've been saying at our food bank is that offering dignity to our shoppers, we call them shoppers, not clients here, doesn't cost anything. Dignity is free. And what that means is that's the way that we greet people when they walk into our food shelf, the way that we have a choice environment. You know, having restrictions on food versus letting people shop and thinking about that welcome, that doesn't cost additional money, but it means everything to the shoppers.
Yeah, because it's already hard to ask for help. It's embarrassing and difficult for people to ask for help. And so when they finally do, it's really helpful to them to not make them feel worse, right?
Yeah, and that's also the intersection of data. So our food bank is unique in that we're doing 40% of our own distribution through our own food shelf, which is unique in the Feeding America network for food banks. And with our data we have, we know that people are invited to shop up to weekly, but they only shop, but half of our shoppers only come once a month. So could shop weekly, but come once a month. So what that tells us is that people aren't coming and getting everything they can. And so just because they could. And so often when we say that we have a shopping experience, it's like a free grocery store without many limits, the pushback can be like, well, people will just take everything they can. It's like, no, we can trust people and believe in them because these shoppers could come every week, but instead they're coming once a month. And so as we tell the story of our shoppers, we want to have the heart behind it, but it's also nice and informative to have that data that shows that we can trust people and that our shoppers know what's best for them and what they need.
That's a really important story to tell. And I think one of the things that everyone in the work can keep learning from is how to best talk about the people we serve and really change the narrative from one of people being needy to people being worth investing in.
Yeah, I agree. And then, listening to those people. So a big change, I think, in the past couple of years has been to say that it's imperative that we listen to those with lived experience about how to best serve them. And our most recent example in Minnesota is that we don't like to box up food. We like for shoppers to have choice. But there's a significant number of our shoppers who are afraid to leave their homes. And so when we realized that was happening and we heard they're not going to open the door for DoorDash, they can't go stand in line with your branded truck for food, we pivoted and we have trusted community partners at our food bank and at food banks and shelves across the state who are picking up food for five households at a time in minivans. So that's what our shoppers need right now, so that's what we'll do. And when it's safe for them to come back out, they'll be shopping for choice at our food shelf, hopefully.
Yeah, we found convenience to be another major thing that people wanted, and anonymity, too. So the nice thing about if you have an efficient drive-up distribution and the food on that distribution is food that people have already said, this is the kind of food we're looking for and what we generally want, and they can go through that line in 15 minutes and not really have to get out of their car and be exposed to other people nearby and sort of be caught getting help, if you will, that people appreciated that. And there are people for whom that solution is the best one for them. And that came from them. That didn't come from us. For years, we were an early adopter of client choice. And the pandemic, one of the things it taught us was there's also room for, if you have the food that people want and need to start with, a drive-up distribution can be just what people are looking for.
Yes, but we need to talk to them and to listen to them. And I think a place where people can, when I say people, I mean the helpers, can get stuck is saying, we're going to ask shoppers about, how to get food out. They don't understand our logistics or our shipping. And it's no, you're not going to ask shoppers to reroute the trucks.
Right.
You're
going to
ask shoppers,
right,
where do they need the food to be and what type of food do they need and when, and then we'll figure out the back end of how to get it there.
So I spent 9.5 years. I shouldn't say spent. I invested 9.5 years of my life in East Africa. And we built schools and medical clinics where there's not ever been anything. So you pull into the village, and it's mud huts and grass roofs. So you could pretty much see what people need. And that is exactly the wrong mindset. The right mindset is what the two of you are talking about, and that you have to listen to understand and not just to respond. And so from that, you can take the learnings, and as Virginia, as you say, you can build the back end to meet that learning, right? You can figure out the operations part of it. But what's the most important part of the conversation the two of you are having right now is that values are non-negotiable. And that is, if you say it's a value like dignity, you don't negotiate on that. That is the hill that you're willing to die on in order to do this work at a different level and be able to pivot towards people's needs and how they can best receive the food. I love this conversation.
Me too. And I think we've had discussions at our board level once, and, you know, when finances are tight, it's like, well, if people don't have enough money for food, why aren't they eating pinto beans that are dried and soaking them in water or trying new cost-effective things? And we had a board member who has lived experience say, when I was unexpectedly a single mother and trying to feed my four children and get back into the workforce, my mental health was not such to have them trying new things. And to me, that makes total sense. And so when you listen to the shoppers, you understand that in order to feed their children, they need to have food that is familiar to them. And you can't just treat people like robots. I guess robots don't eat. That's a bad example. People aren't like livestock that are eating pounds of food and, like, in theory, they can and will eat whatever. And so we need to think about what food we have available and to serve people so that it's something that their kids will recognize and will eat.
Well, and there's consequences to if things get bad enough, right? So you say, well, if things got bad enough, you would eat the oatmeal or the, you know, dried pinto
beans. Yeah, we have people write us about oatmeal.
Yeah. But do you really want things to get bad enough? I mean, you know, it's like, wait a minute, let's not go there. Let's think about a life that's a little bit better than it's as bad as it can get.
I mean, listen, having children for me was humbling. You think you'll be like, okay, well, I'll make this meal, then they'll eat it, and the experts say, offer them a food like 10 times before you say they won't eat it. And I would think about, because at the time when my daughter, then later my son, was like eating, you know, table food, whole foods, you know, not formula or milk, you would watch them like throw food on the floor. And I thought, for me that can afford food, that's one thing, but how would I feel watching this normal developmental milestone if I couldn't get more of that food for tomorrow?
Yeah.
And it's important that children be exposed to different types of food. So do we really want children that are eating like only oatmeal and only pinto beans? And how does that then, even if they're getting the nutrition now, how does that affect them and their attitude toward food later?
Yeah, pinto beans and oatmeal is not exactly the the meal of choice here. Hey, we got to take a quick break here. So chair number one, Virginia Witherspoon, has been an attorney. Chair number two, she has been the CEO for Channel One Food Bank. And chair number three in our next segment is about the chair position she holds at the National Advisory Committee. You all come back and be with us three. Welcome back, everyone. Jerry Brisson, Dr. Phil Knight, and our guest, Virginia Witherspoon, the CEO for Channel One Food Bank in Rochester, Minnesota, and the chair of the NAC, which is the National Advisory Committee for Feeding America. Virginia, help our listeners understand what role the NAC plays, because it's significant.
Yeah, you know, I say jokingly, but not. I think the easiest way to understand it is we're kind of like student council for food banks, because, I mean, we're not the board of Feeding America. Staff doesn't report to us, but we have an important role. We're elected, first of all, we're elected by region, by our peers, and then our role is to keep the staff informed and connected to what's happening on the ground at food banks so that really the Feeding America National Organization can make the best decisions for people experiencing food insecurity, because we're closer to those people than the staff at the national organization.
I absolutely adore that description.
Oh, now I've got Spirit Week going in my head. Like, do you wear different costumes? Like, do you have a pink day or a brown and gold day? Or, I mean,
we have mascot day.
A bake sale.
Well, possibly. So that's really well said, because I have the privilege of serving on the NAC and representing all the partner state associations to the National Advisory Committee. And I love how you put the cookies on the right shelf there. But for our listeners, let's put it in a little perspective. You're the chair for the National Advisory Committee that is elected as a representative up to the administration, the leaders of America's largest charity. So the position that you hold and the entire membership of the National Advisory Committee is not insignificant. And the work there is really important, because with the shift that you talked about earlier in the show, where we put the person who is experiencing hunger at the center of our decision making, and to have that value permeate all of our work is significant.
Yeah, and it especially at a time when the need feels big and resources feel small and the government support is not what it was even a couple of years ago.
Well, and there's this saying, when you've seen one food bank, you've seen one food bank, right? And good things about that and things we should challenge ourselves about. But when you think about being on an advisory committee that represents the 200-plus food banks nationwide that serve every county in the United States and Puerto Rico, and you start to think about what it means to represent the wide variety of work and experience that's out there in the network, I do think it takes a lot of patience. I think it takes a lot of listening skills. But then you got to move things as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a structure with certain challenges, and that's what you're sitting on top of. What's that like for you?
So I love governance, and this might be like the lawyer coming out in me, but people that came before Dr. Phil and I spent a lot of time drafting the NAC policies and spelling out when things are a membership decision and when things are a national office position and when it's shared space. And I think that the debate that we do, you know, this is how the membership is feeling, how does the national office see it? And then also with, you know, there's numerous technology challenges that are coming our way. And I was listening to the audiobook of Brené Brown's new book, Strong Ground, this weekend. And the technology changes that are coming at everyone in the world are high. But also thinking about nonprofits that are used to not having enough and maybe cobbling our technology together. And then having members that are ahead of others and how to bring everyone together. I think it is a lot of listening and a lot of strong communication, and also looking back at our structures and committees and saying, who's the decider and who what information do they need to make a good decision?
And that's a support. That's exactly the definition of support. I mean, when you know who the leader is and you say, what does the leader need? I like that a lot.
So I'm thinking about that. So the first thing I would say is artificial intelligence. And I've said on the show recently, that's the only kind some of the folks I work with have. but AI is here. It's not coming. It's here. And we had Cheryl Kirshenbaum, Dr. Cheryl Kirshenbaum, on the show not long ago, and she made this statement. She said, this is the worst AI you're ever going to work with, because it's only going to get better.
Yep.
And so I think what you're emphasizing there, which fits right into my next question, is really what does the network have to get right in the next few years as you sit atop the leadership of the National Advisory Committee?
I think we need, everyone cares deeply about their own food banks. And I think everyone also cares deeply about food insecurity everywhere. So if any of us leaders had people in line and we were handing them food or inviting them into a food shelf, we wouldn't care what zip code the person had. We would serve them. But as we talk about resources and the right way to share resources across the country, it becomes a lot harder. And I think we're going to have to lean into that. The person experiencing food insecurity, they come first. And it's definitely true that your zip code is going to help determine your access to food.
Mm-hmm.
And so how can we work together and maybe sometimes put aside what's maybe individually best for our own food bank or our own shoppers in whatever state or whatever county we live in, and think about how do we have an impact across the United States to make it so that people in Rochester are more food insecure than somebody, are more food secure than somebody in Michigan? How can we get everybody to food security?
Yeah, and just to explain to our listeners a little bit about the structure, because it's not going to make sense to the average person that you wouldn't do that already, right? But every food bank in the country has its own incorporation, right? They're their own organization. They operate like any nonprofit in your community. And what's unique about us is that we decide to work together nationwide. And we do that through several ways, including through the work of Feeding America, but in other ways too. We decide to work together. But it doesn't solve all of the problems at the local level when we work together. And that's why you have this tension of the work that we do together to meet the needs of every single person who's food insecure, no matter what their zip code is, while food banks still feel very responsible, like any local charity, for the survival, if you will, and the measures and the other things that their boards of directors and their community looks to them to reach. So just trying to explain that structure a little bit, because like I say, the average person will go, why aren't you doing that already? You know,
I really think that we are. I mean, as a network, we send food places that have less. So in Minnesota, we make all kind of food. I'm super lucky to be a food banker here. So, you know, food might not from a national level be sent into Minnesota because it makes sense to send it somewhere else that doesn't make as much food. And people will do it. People in this network will do anything to help each other. But as we look at technology, and if we're all going to, I'm not the IT person, link our systems. Y'all, I had to have a 25-year-old fix my cell phone today. So me talking about this is sort of a whole lot. But my calendar wasn't working and I about cried. But the bottom line is that there's IT professionals. There's a way to link our systems up and to share and work differently. But sometimes that might mean that I feel like my food bank is compromising a little bit. And I think that people will do it, but I think it's going to take a lot of conversation and a lot of continued trust building.
I agree. That's a good conversation, and we didn't get to all of it that we want to talk with you about, so that means you're going to have to come back.
I'd love to. This time flew by. Call anytime.
Okay, great. That's super. That means a lot to Jerry and I. And Virginia Witherspoon, thank you for being with us. Serves as the CEO at Channel One Food Bank in Rochester, Minnesota, and serves as the chair for the National Advisory Committee at Feeding America. There is tons more to talk to you about. We got to take a stop right now, but we're looking forward to having you back. Thanks for being with us, Virginia.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry and I are back to wrap up this edition of Food Secure Nation in just a moment.
Food Secure Nation is sponsored by Know Better, Do Better. Engaging change makers, charting solutions, and driving progress for food security in America. Once again, here are Dr. Phil Knight and Jerry Brisson.
Welcome back, everyone. Jerry Brisson, myself, Dr. Phil Knight. That was Virginia Witherspoon. And three chairs she's sitting in.
Yeah.
She's busy.
Yeah, she's busy. That's exactly right. And she has kids, too. So, you know, there's a lot going on over there. But you know what? What's the saying? When you want something done, ask a busy person.
Well, yeah. And for her leadership of the NAC, she is very precise in her leadership. And I think you're going to see marked progress in how things happen and work product that gets done. I'm excited that she's in that chair. But how she leads the NAC, the National Advisory Committee, I think is fueled by her time as a CEO of Channel One Food Bank.
Well, and seasoned by her time as a lawyer. I mean, what a great story. And one of the things I love about what we do, I'm just going to talk about it for a second, is getting to hear these stories. It's really fascinating for me to listen to all the different ways people get to this work. And of course, that brings a lot of perspective. And Virginia brought a lot of perspective that she has honed and focused on the shoppers in her network. And she says shopper, not client. She does it for a reason. She's focused on making sure people have a dignified experience. And that comes from what? From understanding that if you don't give people what they want and need, it might not actually help them. Right?
Right.
And so if you really want to make a difference, you've got to listen to what people want and need, and you've got to meet them where they are. And we've talked about that. Her experience drives that message home so well. It was really wonderful to listen to.
You know, what was fun for me is to hear her talk about dignity as a value, which I define as a non-negotiable.
Mm-hmm.
It is the hill that you're willing to perish on if necessary. You're not going to compromise on this. And so I feel like that is a message this show can help carry across the nation, that when you're working with people, doing so in a dignified manner so people feel less of a load and more of a lift is paramount to our effectiveness.
And the way she explained it demonstrates a certain kind of competence on top of that compassion, which I love. And Tori Martin talked to us about how trust is built on people having the belief that you are competent and ethical. And So, boy, did Virginia, you know, ring both those bells.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jerry, time for a little food for thought. Leadership is often measured by volume, by how loudly someone speaks or how widely their name is known. But systems are rarely moved by volume. They are moved by steadiness. Today we heard from someone who sits in three chairs at once, a lawyer who understands structure, a local leader who absorbs shock, a national advisor helping align a complex network. None of those roles are glamorous. All of them are necessary. Food security doesn't advance because one person dominates the conversation. It advances because perspectives travel from local to national and back again. If we want a stronger system, we don't need more passion. We need leaders who can see from more than one chair at a time. And that's how we build a food secure nation.